You're listening to the free edition of Sweden in Focus from The Local. If you would like to listen to a full-length version of the podcast, as well as an additional midweek episode, please check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade to Membership Plus. Here's this week's free edition.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Sweden in Focus, The Local's weekly podcast, where we review the news and dig into other interesting aspects of life in this country we call Sweden. On this week's show, we're going to be chatting about what the rest of the world makes of Sweden's recent election result. And after weeks of non-stop election coverage, we'll lighten the tone a bit to talk about mushroom picking. But the respite will be brief because we want to discuss how the government talks are going, the impact of the Swedish Central Bank's bombshell interest rate hike, and finally, we'll talk about a controversial feature of Sweden's education system that allows schools to make a profit. I'm Paul O'Mahony, and with me to thrash all this out, I have James Savage here in Stockholm, and we are also delighted to be joined by Le Monde's Scandinavia correspondent Anne-Françoise Hivert, who is in the Malmö studio with our regular panellists Richard Orange and Becky Waterton. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
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 Welcome to Sweden in Focus, Anne-Françoise, and thank you for joining us. Can I just begin by asking you to tell listeners a little bit about yourself, where you're from, how long you've lived in Sweden, and what your work involves?
Sure. So I'm French. I come from a region which is called Brittany, Bretagne, in the west part of France. I moved to Sweden about 20 years ago to come and live with the guy who became my husband. I live in Lund. I have three French-Swedish kids, and I've been working as a correspondent for 20 years, covering the Nordic countries. And since 2016, I took over the correspondence for Le Monde. And I write about everything that has to do with the Nordic countries, from economy to sports to politics to society, environment, etc.
Excellent. And you covered the recent election for Le Monde. Can I ask you what the reaction was in France to the Sweden Democrats becoming the second largest party and a potential kingmaker in the new government?
Yes, I think there was shock. That was quite obvious on the Monday after the election that the Sweden Democrats could actually get 20% and become the second party in Sweden, and not only because it's this party, but it's the party which has a special history when you compare it to other radical right-wing parties, populist parties in Europe. If you compare it to the Danish People's Party or the Fremskrittspartiet in Norway, etc., that's not the same party. So I think that was quite a shock in France. Then there is quite a lot of misunderstanding, I would say, about the future of the negotiation. There is still thoughts in France that the right wing, the traditional right wing, Moderaterna, Christian Democrats and Liberals could actually build a coalition without them, and not understanding that there is actually an agreement before the election that they would collaborate together.
Yeah, and I guess that's a mathematical question as well, isn't it? They couldn't really do that just because they wouldn't have the support in Parliament without them.
Yes, and I think that the misunderstanding is more that the fact that they would have a choice that they have always before decided not to work with the extreme right in Sweden, and that's a choice that they stopped making, or they made another choice since 2018, realizing that they would never come back to power if they are not collaborating with the SD. They could actually, if they wanted to collaborate with the Centre Party or Social Democrat, etc. When we live in Sweden, we know it's not going to happen, that they want to try something else. They have been clear about that. They have already published different programs together when it comes to immigration, to criminality, to retirement, etc.
Even so, their budget last year as well. That
yes.
was very clear, yeah. Kind of two teams appearing.
Which is a bit strange, I think, because in the on the European stage, Johan Persson, the leader of the Liberals, is trying to tell his friends inside his group that it's actually the other parties who made the decision to work with the Sweden's Democrats, so that he doesn't really have a choice, which is not true.
Yeah,
he has a choice.
If he went over to the left bloc, then they would have won. Like, he has that choice. Yeah. He is literally the person who can change everything.
It was interesting a few days ago that the Liberal group in the European Parliament actually took the Swedish Liberals to task for their plans to collaborate with the Sweden Democrats. I mean, what do we know about that, James?
We know that there was a group meeting of ALDE in the European Parliament. Sweden's or the Swedish Liberal MEP Karin Karlsbro got quite a lot of came in for quite a lot of criticism. Now she wasn't in favour of this alliance with the Sweden Democrats and the moderates, but she nonetheless was, you know, bore the brunt of a lot of the criticism in the European Parliament from the other members of her sort of broader European party. And you know, this has been really difficult because a lot of other parties in the Liberal group in Renew see the radical right, the far right, as their main adversary, whereas the Liberals in Sweden have effectively chosen to see the Social Democrats as their main adversary, which is, you know, goes back to sort of a long history of sort of taking that position, with only a sort of a small window in the last few years where they sort of chose to ally themselves with the Social Democrats. And, you know, but they've gone back to their traditional position, which is, you know, our main adversary is the Social Democrats. We want to see a centre-right government, and in order to do that, we need to ally with the Sweden Democrats. It's a very difficult thing for them to explain to these liberal parties in other parts of Europe, I think.
I think just one thing also, that it happens exactly the day after, 2 days after, there was a voting in the parliament where actually the Sweden's Democrats voted against the proposal to label Hungary as a non-democratic country. And I think that also showed what could come in the future, that they are not voting like the Liberals, they are not a party like the others in this collaboration.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting with the Sweden Democrats in the European Parliament is they've often voted pro-Russian as well, in, you know, whereas in Sweden they've tried to distance themselves a lot from Russia. In the European Parliament, their group, including them, have often voted in a way that's been perceived as sort of as pro-Russian, which is, you know, different.
Have Swedes been surprised by the coverage abroad, which has focused so much on a Swedish government being reliant on a party with roots in the neo-Nazi movement?
I think this kind of goes back to that old joke of, like, the first time a Swede meets a foreigner, the first thing they say is, oh, I wonder what they think of Sweden. Like, I've seen a lot of stories about, like, this is what the rest of Europe is saying about Sweden. Actually, quoting some of your articles, Anne-Françoise, like, there's been a lot of things like Le Monde is saying this and Der Spiegel is saying that. And I don't know if they're surprised or if it's just kind of curiosity at what the rest of the world is saying.
I think a lot of people in other countries that have a less proportional electoral systems find it quite hard to compute proportional electoral systems like the Swedish one. So, you know, that goes for Brits, Americans, and I think maybe French people as well, and trying to understand the, you know, the need for parties to compromise and the need for parties to work together is I think, you know, it is a very different political system to the one you get in a more majoritarian system, where these tensions are worked out within very broad parties, often, like, you know, the Republicans or the Conservatives.
And I had some problems to explain also the fact that even if they don't get into government, it doesn't mean that they're not going to have influence, which is a belief that I've had colleagues saying that, well, are they going to be in government? No, probably not. He's not going to be prime minister? No, probably not. Oh, that's for sure, actually. But that doesn't mean that nothing, I mean, everything is as usual. You're going to have a government which is has 30% of the vote in the parliament, which is going to be dependent on a party that has 20% of the vote, which is obviously going to require a lot, who is going to be in the position to blackmail the other, more or less, every time a budget or some big decision is going to be voted in parliament. And we've seen what has happened in other countries. I think about Denmark, for example, when Danish People's Party were the support party of the right wing for like 10 years between 2001 and 2011 and again after. And there has been major change in the policy, immigration policy, but also in the way you talk about foreigners, the old conception, the fact that now the Social Democrats agree with everything that the Danish People's Party is saying. So it's, and that I think is quite hard to understand sometimes also abroad. And there is a lot of people waiting for to see what's going to happen with the government talks and what's going to come out of it.
I mean, they've already said, I mean, this is kind of Aftonbladet, so one of the tabloids in Sweden has already said that their sources are saying that the four parties have already agreed on tightening up migration policy. Yes. And I mean, we've been looking at what, how do they all feel about permanent residency permits and citizenship. I mean, you can see they all kind of agree. The moderates have moved closer towards the Sweden Democrats already. All of the parties have, arguably. That's why we saw that during the election campaign. And I think even if the Sweden Democrats aren't in power, just the fact that people have moved closer to their politics.
Because that's what happened, actually. It's not when you ask political scientists or people who have been following the extreme right since 20, 30 years, it's not SD which has changed. It's the others who have changed. The line is the same. The proposal is the same. You still have the same scandals. Of course, it's not the same party as in 1988, but there is a continuity. It's the same ideas. There is still the idea, which is now formulated more clear about the big replacement that you have to fight Muslims coming to Sweden, that you have to now. They are talking about returning people, which they had stopped doing a couple of years ago when they were trying to get into good terms with the right wing. Now they're using this kind of wordings. The number two in the party has said that they have become more radical. He acknowledged it himself. And any political scientist you talk to will say that it's really not them, it's the others, the three other parties, and even the Social Democrat have changed also.
Yeah, I mean, we saw that when Annie Lööf stepped down. She was like, I'm the only one that's not moved. Everyone else has moved around me and I'm standing here and you've all kind of, I've not changed, you have, in a way, which I think was very telling.
We're going to take a break now from politics to go fungal for a while. And I know from watching my own in-laws that Swedes love hunting for mushrooms once autumn comes round. And sometimes I've even joined them and maybe even enjoyed it a bit. But just how popular is mushroom picking in Sweden, Richard?
I'd say it's close to universal. I'd say not everyone, but everyone I know in Sweden does at least do it once or twice a year. I don't know about you. I mean, no.
we're both shaking our heads here.
Well, at least in my wife's family, everybody, they all do it. And what my wife always says is that in England, it's always seen as, you know, foraging, like a kind of new trend. You know, the Guardian always goes on about, you know, foraging for mushrooms in different forests. And she says, well, for us, it's not like foraging. It's not a trend. It's just something you do. It's completely unremarkable. You just go out and, you know, when it's the time to pick mushrooms, you will go out and come back with a basket full of chanterelles. And I'd say it's pretty popular. There's huge Facebook groups with tens, if not hundreds of thousands of members.
But in Sweden, it's you know, compared to other parts of Europe, which are much more densely populated, Sweden, relatively sparsely populated, lots and lots of forests. I mean, the chances of you having a mushroom picking spot very close to where you live is quite large, and it doesn't require that much organisation or effort to go out and do it, which is one of the lovely things about it, I think.
Richard, I've got kind of a sensitive question for you. Are you a basket thief?
Am I a basket thief? I am. No, yeah.
He was called out on Twitter.
I've been called out on Twitter because I posted a picture of the one solitary mushroom that I managed to pick when I went out yesterday, and which was a beautiful, huge cauliflower fungus, I think it's called, which is, I don't know what it
is. It was an amazing mushroom, yeah.
It's an amazing mushroom. And I tweeted it out, and one of my friends in Malmo said,
nice basket you've got there, or something on Twitter. Because, and it's a her basket, it turns out.
will you be reuniting it with its rightful owner?
I think I'll have to give it back now. I don't think it's not me who nicked it, actually. It's my wife. But
yeah. That's what they all say, Richard.
You found this amazing mushroom yesterday. This cauliflower mushroom, which was absolutely huge. What are your top tips when you go out picking?
I think the thing that I did wrong when we first went out is I would sort of go out with a mushroom book of all the mushrooms that you can get. And as soon as I saw a mushroom, I'd pick it and try and identify it and find out if you can eat it, which is completely the wrong way to do it. The thing to do is to learn what a chanterelle or canterelle looks like and learn what a Kaliahansvamp or a sep looks like and just go out looking for that. And I suppose another top tip is not to go out too early. I think the thing I used to do when I first came here is to, as soon as, you know, it was autumn, I'd be straight out in the forests and I'd go around for an hour and find absolutely nothing and then give up for the rest of the year. And the secret is it's kind of worth waiting until there's quite a lot out there. Otherwise, you will just get bored and give up. When I went out yesterday down here, it was... you could tell just walking through the wood that it's too early because there's still kind of long grass from the summer. You want it to be kind of like damp moss under your feet, I think, to really be finding a lot of mushrooms. And yeah, it's probably about the right time up where you guys are in Stockholm, but it's a bit early in Skåne.
Great. I think will you be out picking, James, very soon?
I was out last weekend. It was wonderful. I got loads of chanterelles and it was fantastic. Just next to where I got my summer house. It was just going to the little forest and start picking. It was gorgeous.
Well, wasn't it nice to talk about something other than politics for a few minutes? But we're going to get back to it now because the Speaker of Parliament has tasked the Moderate Party leader, Ulf Kristersson, with forming a new government. How is that going? Is Ulf Kristersson making any progress, James?
Well, yeah, I mean, the first bit of progress was getting tasked by the Speaker with forming a government, and that was pretty inevitable that he was going to do that, but now that is done. According to Aftonbladet yesterday, I think Becky was referring to that article earlier, they seem to have got some good sources there, and so according to them, the negotiations are well underway, that they're making progress on issues like immigration and tougher sentencing rules for criminals as well. Negotiations are being done apparently by sort of fairly unknown officials in the party's headquarters. It's not being done directly at leader level, it's being done at a lower level. But they've been preparing for many, many months and years for this, and they've done a lot of the groundwork. So I think they know a lot of the areas where they might be able to form, you know, some sort of agreement. But the thing is, forming a government, and this is the difficult bit, forming a government means, first of all, getting agreement on the things that on the big issues. But then you've got to form agreement on all sorts of smaller issues as well. And then, as a party, you've got to sell those agreements in to your MPs. And any agreement formed is going to need to be sold into everyone from all the Liberals MPs, some of whom are not particularly happy with the direction the party has taken, and the Sweden Democrat MPs who, you know, are not very happy with, well, don't really like the Liberals very much. So, you know, that compromise is going to be made at official level, but then it's going to have to be sold in at other levels in the different parties. But so far, it seems that it's going according to plan. The big test is going to be on Monday, the first big test, at least, when they need to vote on a new speaker. And so we'll see if they can manage to agree on a candidate and, crucially, see if they can manage to get their MPs to all vote in the right way, according to party lines, on the new candidate.
Yeah, let's bring Becky in there. You mentioned that the parliamentary speaker has a key role in selecting prime ministerial candidates. And 4 years ago, Andreas Norlén became a household name as he served sort of endless plates of biscuits to Sweden's party leaders in the 134 days it took to form a government after the 2018 election. Will Andreas Norlén continue as speaker?
Probably not. There's no specific rules for which party should be the party who is supplying the speaker. The way that the Social Democrats do it is that it's the biggest party in the Riksdag, the parliament, and the way that the moderates have traditionally done it is it's the biggest party in their bloc, which until now has always been them. So The Sweden Democrats have been saying, oh, well, you always give it to the biggest party in your block. That's us. Why don't we have the speaker? And the moderates have been not particularly happy about doing that. I've seen a bit of pushback against the idea of the Sweden Democrats supplying the speaker, because it would then be Björn Söder, who is, or potentially be Björn Söder, who's made some controversial comments saying that he said that Jewish people and Sami people aren't Swedes. So there was a lot of people saying, well... Hello, Roya. So there's a lot of people saying, well, if you are saying that these two groups aren't Swedes, how can you be the speaker who is representing all of Swedes? It's not really clear. So maybe they'll negotiate that the moderates will supply the speaker, and then I assume Andreas Norlin would stay on, or maybe the Sweden Democrats have negotiated that they'll have the speaker. Maybe it would be Björn Söder, maybe it was someone else in the Sweden Democrats. It's kind of not very clear.
And there is a special rule, which is that you are voting... it's a secret voting,
yeah, exactly.
Which means also that even if a decision is made, there is not absolutely 100% certainty that all the Liberals, if they have made an agreement, because apparently Aftonbladet was saying that they might have managed to make an agreement. If the name is actually Björn Söder, it's not really sure that all the Liberals will actually vote for him.
Yeah.
And we would not know who voted against or for. So it's going to be very hard to guarantee that the person they decide on is actually going to be elected, yeah, on Monday.
You can vote against party lines and no one knows that you voted against party lines. It's actually kind of exciting.
There is actually a petition, yeah, online as well against Björn Söder. I don't know if you've seen,
yeah,
it.
In the meantime, yeah. Yeah.
Yesterday they had like 60,000 people who had signed it. I assume it's more today.
And you know, as well as the Liberals, you could envisage, you know, it would only need one or two moderates or even Christian Democrats voting in a secret ballot against Björn Söder as speaker. I mean, it's not inconceivable.
It sounded to me from listening to Richard's dog that Richard's dog is in favour of Andreas Norlin continuing.
He is.
As soon as you mention Björn Söder.
Exactly.
I've seen some calls to actually vote for someone else as well, to have like a centre party, someone that would be judged more neutral somehow.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
And is it interesting, I don't know how seriously to take the Aftonbladet article, because I think in this there's such a... I know journalists are going to come out with something they know will just fly. And what they've said is very, you know, we've agreed to have stricter sentences. They didn't have any specifics, really.
Yeah, it's kind of generic.
No. It's very generic. Yeah. I think take it with a pinch of salt. But they in that article, they said that the speaker position is a key part of the negotiations. And it's seen as part of the entirety of the negotiations. So, which I would indicate means that the Sweden Democrats want that as a, I don't know, part payment.
Especially if they don't have any minister jobs, which they are still insisting on.
Yeah. So I think precisely. There's quite a high chance that we're going to see a Sweden Democrat, at least Sweden Democrats agreeing on a speaker. I don't know if they're actually going to be voted in, but I think they're going to be lobbying for that.
And they want a big win, a symbolic win. They need a symbolic win, because if they don't, they're probably not going to enter the government. None of the other parties. I mean, they are liberal. They are enough liberals saying that they won't vote for a government where there is SD ministers. So if they don't have that, they really need a big symbolic win. And it can't be just the immigration and criminal policy, because I think that they already... I'm not sure it's actually so hard for them to agree on this. Mm-hmm. They already have made proposals together. And what Aftonbladet is picking up is a proposal that they were already on in this... The measure they're mentioning, they were already in the proposal that they have.
They were campaigning on those issues.
Yes. Nothing new. All of it was already decided before. So it doesn't seem to be the point where there is going to be so much friction. I think it's in other issue that they're going to have to agree.
And it's worth pointing out that Björn Söder, this controversial Sweden Democrat, has already been the deputy speaker. So in the first term of the Social Democrat government, he was the deputy speaker and, you know, was controversial, but appeared to have sort of have quite a taste for the position and to enjoy the ceremony. And it's not a massive step to have a Sweden Democrat speaker.
The choice of Björn Söder, I've heard from people following the party, is actually quite interesting, because Björn Söder and Jimmie Åkesson are not on good terms anymore. He didn't invite Björn Söder on the stage the evening of the campaign, when he invited all of the closest collaborators, including the two others from the beginning there, Jomsoff.
So it might be trying to get rid of him.
Yes, and it's a way... it's been quite, he's very political and not always saying what the party line is, and been considered a bit extremist sometimes by the others. So if he gets that job, then he will be limited in what he can say, because he's, as a tall man, you are quite neutral, yeah, even if you
and
have...
You can't be a member of parliament either anymore, can you?
Yeah. So it's also a way to somehow get rid of him.
But I think the risk is, like Becky says, the risk is actually, if you're worried about, you know, the threat to Swedish democracy from the Sweden Democrats getting influence, the risk of having a Sweden Democrat speaker is quite large.
He could theoretically propose three random people that don't have a majority and then trigger a new election.
That's true. Yeah, the power to cause chaos, absolutely. And, you know, that's, chaos is, you know, sometimes used by populist parties to their advantage.
Just one thing I think that that has been mentioned but hasn't gotten that much attention is that there is a lot of discussion about actually if they don't get into government. And yes, there is this post in the parliament as a tall man, and there are other posts and other functions in the parliament. But there is also requirement from SD to have people actually being hired in the ministries, SD people.
Like tjänstemän.
Yes. Yeah. And that's something else, because I think that what we've seen in the US, for example, during Trump's time, is that you had people, a lot of people changing nominations made by Trump, which actually changed quite for some long time how agencies and ministries work. And I think that's something where they can actually get a lot of influence in the future. So I think that we should actually be looking at that too.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to follow. If we go back to Andreas Norlén, he became sort of synonymous with his small biscuits 4 years ago, but he's not serving them this time, Becky, is he?
No, he is. He is following his tradition of being Sverige's trevligaste man, the nicest man in Sweden, by serving chocolate and his own homegrown tomatoes to Ulf Kristersson and to all the other party leaders. But this is maybe a little bit off topic. What I don't understand, he was serving like big kind of beef tomatoes, but like, does he expect people to eat them like an apple? Like, there was no like knife and a little chopping board and stuff. Like, how does he expect? I get a cherry tomato, like munching. Like, is he expecting Ulf to like take a big tomato and take a bite out of it like an apple? Because that, sorry, it's just, I just saw this picture and that's the first thing I thought. Anyway, no, it's very on brand for Andreas Norlén. I will definitely miss him because he is great. And I'm allowed to say that because he's not political, so that's not partisan.
No, and everybody likes him. He is kind of a unifying force in Swedish
politics.
He's
a good advert for a ceremonial president, actually, I think. You know, you can think, yeah. I mean, imagine having him instead of a king.
Yeah, me and Richard were saying he should be king.
He should be king.
I also quite like the Swedish king. So.
He has his own TV show as well.
Yeah, Talman. Yeah. We'll have to get a new puppet if Björn Söder takes over.
He's also an arch monarchist, so I don't think he'd like...
Yeah, he probably wouldn't like to be king.
but you know, I think if there's one thing that might save him is that he's so popular among people in general, but also he is very conservative, which probably goes down well among some Sweden Democrat voters as well. So, you know, it wouldn't necessarily be a terribly unpopular thing for the Sweden Democrats to allow him to stay. It might not be terribly unpopular with their own voters, at least.
And we'll be back after this short break.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Okay, we're back. So on Tuesday, Sweden's central bank, the Riksbank, announced its biggest interest rate hike in 30 years. Can you explain, Richard, why the Riksbank deemed it necessary to raise interest rates by a full percentage point?
The main reason is simply the August inflation figure, which came in at 9%. And it had dipped in July, and everyone has thought, oh, maybe inflation is starting to get under control. Maybe some of the earlier hikes have started to have an impact. And then it bounced back with this, again, like the highest inflation rate in 30 years. I think it's the highest since 1991. So it justified taking tougher action. And in the press conference, Stefan Ingves, the governor of the bank, he was saying that he kind of did a mea culpa. He said, a lot of our prognoses have turned out to be wrong, and the only thing we can do is apologise for that. And he argued that if they don't act with a little bit more power now, it means that, you know, inflation expectations could take hold and it will start becoming part of salary negotiations. And then you'll need even higher rates to tame inflation in like 2 or 3 years' time. So it's better to act more forcefully earlier than to leave it too late and let the genie out of the bottle, so to speak. But it's not just that. If you look at what other central banks are doing, that central banks are always kind of looking at over their shoulders at their counterparts in other countries, is that they've taken even more action. So if you look at the Fed, you know, just after Sweden's decision, the Fed came out with an even more aggressive rate hike, I think to 3 and a bit percent, or between 3 and 3.5%. And I mean, that's not in one go. That's the core rate itself. And Stefan Ingves, he showed a chart in the press release showing where the Riksbank is compared to other central banks. And, you know, in typical Swedish style, it's somewhere in the middle. It's kind of a lagom reaction. He was asked, as they're always asked, is a lot of people, when inflation started to go up, just said it's just energy prices, it's external, there's no kind of endemic inflation. And he sort of quite falsely said, no, you know, even if you strip out energy, even if you strip out other goods that are dependent on energy, inflation is still going up across the board. It's not purely because of the war in Ukraine or gas prices. It goes beyond that. And so we need to act more aggressively. And he was asked if he thought it might lead to an economic downturn. And he said that it will definitely have an impact on growth and might even have a short sort of negative growth next year.
And what are the main sort of ramifications of the rate hike for anyone living in Sweden?
Mortgages. It's gonna put your mortgage payments up. So you're gonna have to be paying more per month. I mean, it also depends how much banks are gonna increase by. But if we assume that banks increase by the same amount, then depending on the size of your mortgage, you could be looking at a couple of thousand krona more a month. Which is especially if you're thinking if your energy prices are gonna be going up as well. That's a significant difference, really. And then I guess hopefully the idea is that it's going to slow down inflation. So hopefully in the long run, we'll see kind of a slowdown to the increases in food prices and everything that we've been seeing at the moment. But the main impact I think people are going to see is if you have any kind of loan that you're paying interest off on, then that interest payment is going to be higher.
Unless you've managed to fix your rates before.
Yeah, unless you've got fixed
rates.
In
which case, congratulations.
Yes.
And you're probably going to see a downturn on the housing market.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah. I am still trying to sell my apartment after a month, so I'm slightly worried about this. It's going to make people
not
even
the best time.
No.
Sweden in Focus is free to listen to, but is made possible by readers becoming members of The Local Sweden. If you're not yet a member, you can support us by heading to thelocal.se and subscribing with the reduced rate for podcast listeners at thelocal.se/podcast offer. And finally for today, we're going to discuss a controversial quirk of Sweden's education system that allows private companies to own and operate schools and pay dividends on the profits to their shareholders. Now, obviously, school choice is an issue that affects a lot of listeners, so we thought we'd dig into it a little bit. And this is just one aspect of the education system, but it's worth exploring because it is quite unique to Sweden. What's the history of this, James? Why did Sweden decide to allow for-profit schools? What's the kind of rationale behind it?
Well, it came about in 1992, thanks to the Carl Bildt government. It's sort of a centre-right government. The ultimate purpose was to increase choice, variation, and to encourage cost-effectiveness in the school sector. Obviously, there is an ideological element in this as well, in allowing companies to make, in allowing those who are running schools to make profits. If you know, the moderates started from a position of saying, well, there's nothing wrong with making profits. We're in favour of making profits. We are pro-business. But it was also, you know, from an education perspective, the idea was to allow people to find schools that were different from their local commonal council school, to, you know, to escape a bad council school, to encourage schools to compete and then get, you know, get better and raise standards across the board, better serve parents' requirements, also give opportunities for schools with a religious focus or particular sort of teaching philosophies. And this reform now is around 30 years old, so it's very well established, and in some respects has been copied around the world, but with a big difference that nobody else has copied this idea of allowing schools to make profits, allowing these school companies to be profit-seeking. In most other countries, they are foundations or, you know, other kinds of non-profits. But in Sweden, they decided that that profit-making schools was just going to encourage more of these free schools to start.
Yeah. So I guess, like as you say, it's been around for 30 years now, which means that we can make an assessment as to whether it actually works. And can I ask you that, Anne-Françoise, does this system work?
Well, that would depend on who you ask, I would say. I think that's it's worth noting as well that there is a big difference with Sweden and the rest of the world, and that's the profit part. But another aspect of it is that it's 100% publicly funded. And it's funded according to a model that is also unique in the world, which was an idea from Milton Friedman, a very neoliberal economist, which is this education check, this school that the commune gives to the school, no matter if they are private or public, depending on how many students they have. It's a certain amount that follows the students, and which means that the only way for the schools to get money is to attract the more students you can and to reduce your cost, then you can make profit. And that's also something that is very discussed today. The debate has focused on the profit part, but you have a lot of people now talking about that maybe the idea would be to actually reform the system of skolpengar, which means that communal schools have much more works and functions, etc., much more cost, but they're getting the same amount of money as private schools. So
and
maybe we should...
responsibilities as well.
Exactly,
yeah.
Because they have to have room for students when they move to the city. They have to have a flexible amount of seats in the class, etc. They need also to often to take kids which have more difficulties. There is a queue system which is making also that the private school can actually have some kind of selection system in place. They do it. They are not allowed to do it, but we don't know what they are doing because it's considered as a secret. It's a company secret, so we don't know how they're dealing with the line. And even if they are not doing the selection themselves, the fact that some parents are actually putting the kids in line when they're born is a natural selection, I would say, because, of course, the parents who are concerned with the future of their kids, if you are putting your kids in line.
Or the parents who are in Sweden.
Exactly.
Like if you move to Sweden, you've got a four-year-old and you want to start school, you're already 4 years behind everyone else.
Yes. So it's so to answer your question, does it work? There is a huge amount of criticism coming from Sweden, coming from outside of Sweden. There is the reports from the OECD PISA report, not only on the result, but also making more detailed investigations saying that it's been contributing to the segregation of schools, of a lot of different differences between the private and the communal school. There is a report from the Riksrevision, which is an national agency that is controlling how the public finance are used, from June, that say that it's this school Penga, the education check system doesn't work and it has to be reformed, and that it should have a different financing for the communal and for the private schools. But as you said, it's been 30 years and there is 400,000 kids going to the private school. You have companies making a lot of money and saying that if you make some reforms that is going to hurt us, then we're going to close down, and then you have 400,000 kids without school. So it's pretty powerful argument to not do anything. And I don't think that a lot is going to happen, because you have three right-wing parties and the Sweden Democrat now that are again a reform of the profit in the school system.
you notice that the free school lobby is very, very strong. And I've always been quite surprised.
They have a lot of money. They've all earned a lot of money running free schools. Like, that's why they're strong.
Well, yes, but what I was going to say is I'm always very surprised how some of these big lobbying organisations, you know, Svenskt Näringsliv, Confederation of Swedish Industry, Almega, a lot of them spend an awful lot of time and focus on defending the free school concept. And I think, you know, it's become a major priority for the industry lobby as a whole. And because I think there's so much money sloshing around.
If you want to take it up a level, it's the disadvantage, you know, in the 1990s, when you brought the market into the public welfare system, you thought, well, it'll make it more efficient. Look at businesses, they're more efficient. And that's probably true. But I think what people didn't anticipate was the extent to which you set up an incentive for private companies to corrupt the system, to kind of co-opt municipal and central government officials and then sort of gouge the welfare system for profit, and how hard it is to put in place regulations to stop that happen, because the people who are going to put in the regulation are the people who are being offered these nice chairmanships when they retire. And when you bring the market into the public sector, it's very hard to keep everyone honest, I think.
And you have a lot of politicians. That's really crazy that it's so not discussed, or not that much discussed in Sweden, because we have the image of ourselves as being one of the less corrupted country in the world. And it's not corruption, but it's really close to... There is no quarantine time between the fact that you're a civil servant or you're a politician in a high job and going to the private. And you will have politicians who have been dealing with these questions in the school, in the elderly care, in the health, selling different municipal activities to private companies when they were in the municipal leadership, and then going to the private sector a couple of days after they have stopped being politicians, and they're going to work for this company. So that's, and there are a lot of them, a lot of former ministers working for these private school companies. You have a politician, the president of the Friskolors Riksförbund is a former moderate. You have a lot of moderate, but you also have a lot of social democrats.
Friskolans Riksförbund, that's the association of free schools.
And that's why if you poll people in Sweden, a vast majority of voters are against allowing schools to make profits and this
too.
System, and teachers, and even voters on the right, even moderate voters, even Centre Party voters are opposed to this, and yet their parties do not reflect what their voters think, and that indicates that something is wrong. If they're not representing their voters, who are they representing?
Yeah. And just to illustrate why this is a concern, I think, you know, Richard did a really good investigation into one chain of free schools earlier this year, the International Engelska Skolan. He spoke to a lot of teachers who were working at these schools, and what became clear is that, you know, they were saving money by paying teachers who they brought in from other countries lower salaries than many of their Swedish counterparts were being paid. And that led to quite a lot of staff turnover, but also it allowed this company to increase its margins, which then, you know, were siphoned away from the school system and then, you know, kept by the company. And the question then is this how taxpayers want their tax money to be spent? Is this the most efficient way of providing children with a good education? Does it provide children with a better education? It raises a lot of questions, I think.
Because I think isn't the reason that they get school paying was because they didn't want people to have to pay for free schools. They wanted
it's the social democrats actually making this decision after Carl Bildt's government. At the time of Carl Bildt's government, the private school were getting 85% of the amount of money that the public school were getting. And when the social democrats came back to power, they decided that it should be 100%, because then it should be a free choice. The Wahlfreiheit should be for everyone and not just for the rich who were able to pay the difference.
Chile, a few years ago, which was pretty much the poster child for this sort of Milton Friedman influenced voucher system, it reversed a very similar system to Sweden. And it was, I think, pretty much the only country in the world that allowed, apart from Sweden, that allowed companies to make profits and take them out. And they reversed it. And I don't know how well it's gone, but they did it. So people who say, oh, there's 400,000 pupils, it can't be done. It can be done. It has been done in Chile. So,
but it's a bit striking, I think, that the Swedes, often when you talk with Swedes journalists or others, are not really aware that the Swedish system is a absolutely unique, and that it's actually seen from the outside as something that is crazy, totally extreme, and doesn't work. And I think they're starting to discover that. The left-wing candidate in the election, Dag Gostar, said that in a debate, that we are the only one in the world who are doing it. Why? That's the proof that it doesn't work. Otherwise, the others would do that. And that, I think, could actually make Swedes start to move on that question, because you were talking about the image of Sweden before, and I think that's also something they would understand, that the image of Sweden, the image of the school system being not working and being going very wrong. I think that we've seen also in the campaign that some parties, the Centre Party and the Liberals, have started to make a really small step towards reforming the system, that you should not allow the profit for the five first years of the school being built, for example. That's what the Liberal wanted. The Centre Party want to have more control in the schools and limit the profit for the schools, which doesn't work. So
and
you
some
see
of them also want to reform the queue system, at least. Yeah. So it should be more transparent. There should be, you shouldn't be able to put someone in a queue from birth, that kind of thing. So there are definitely movements towards changing it. Not quite getting rid of it completely, but changing it slightly, which I guess is, like you said, it's starting on the path.
If you start reforming even on the margin, then it might actually hurt the companies, and then you will see very quickly, you might see very quickly some action from the companies not being so interested in being in Sweden as much as they have been before. So we'll see what happens, but it doesn't necessarily need huge reforms to have a change in the situation.
That's all we have time for today. Thank you for listening, and make sure to check out the links in the show notes if you want to read up more on some of the topics we've covered. A big thank you to Anne-Françoise Hivert for joining us. Our regular panelists this week were Becky Waterton, Richard Orange and James Savage. Our sound engineer is Rhys Edwards. I'm Paul O'Mahony, and we'll be back again with another episode of Sweden in Focus next Saturday. Until then, take care. That's all for this week's free edition of Sweden in Focus. If you'd like to hear a full-length version of the podcast each week, as well as an additional midweek episode with more interviews and analysis, please upgrade to Membership Plus. Make sure to check the episode notes for details on how to upgrade. Sweden in Focus is a podcast by The Local Europe. Our sound engineer is Rhys Edwards. The publisher is James Savage.